Hey, everybody, thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Preacher Boys podcast. I make this show for you, and I hope that you really enjoy it. I have a lot of people that ask me how they can support the show financially, and you can do that by heading over to patreon.com/preacherboys. You're going to get access to exclusive content, including early releases of episodes. I've got a couple episodes right now that have been released at least a month early over on Patreon. You've got access to things like unique merch, depending on what tier you join, and you get access to some behind the scenes content that I'm posting within the group. So head over to patreon.com/preacherboys and become a member over there today. Every single supporter helps make this show a little bit more possible, especially as I continue to add additional episodes and content every single week. Thank you so much for tuning in. Let's get back to the show.
Trigger warning. This podcast contains descriptions of various abusive situations. Listener discretion is advised. You are listening to the Preacher Boys podcast, a podcast shedding light on decades of mental, physical, and sexual abuse within the independent fundamental Baptist movement. The testimonies shared on this podcast are told from the personal experience and perspective of the survivors. Not all legal outcomes are known or final. Any suspect is presumed innocent until proven guilty in the court of law. To find more information about the Preacher Boys podcast and upcoming documentary, visit PreacherBoysDoc.com or connect on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter with the handle @PreacherBoysDoc. Now, here is your host, Eric Skwarzynski.
Hey, everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Preacher Boys podcast. This is a very powerful episode. I sit down with Rebecca Foltz, who talks about her time at several churches in Northern California, Southern California, and ending up in Nevada. And she just gets extremely transparent about three situations of sexual assault that took place across these different churches and how each church worked proactively to cover up those situations. We talk a lot about mental health and the way that that affected it. We talk about the church's view on sexuality, and we talk a little bit about the college culture at Golden State Baptist College and the way that Jack Treiber actually personally responded to one of the allegations that was made when Rebecca called from her church in San Diego to ask him for his advice. And so it's a really heavy episode, but also a really powerful one. Rebecca's an amazing fighter, survivor, and her perseverance and her strength through all of this is really incredible. And I know it's going to be encouraging to you guys. So be sure to listen to the very end. I think she has some really important takeaways that people need to be thinking about when we think about abuse within the IFB movement. And really, I think this is one of my favorite conversations. It just gets really real, really deep, and I think really hits the heart. I think Rebecca really hits the heart of some of the abuse issues within this movement. So be sure to check it out. Let me know what you guys think, and be sure to share this with someone who you think it would be helpful for. I think everyone needs to listen to at least this episode. I mean, it's whether you're a pastor, whether you're a church, whether you're a survivor yourself or trying to help a survivor, there's something in here that you need to hear. So without any further ado, here's my interview with Rebecca Foltz. All right, Becca, thank you so much for joining me on the Preacher Boys podcast. I know I gave a little bit of context about who you are in the introduction, but can you just add a little bit more context for people who are listening about who you are and how you first got introduced to the IFB movement?
Well, thank you for allowing me to talk with you today. I really appreciate that. My name is Becca, and I was actually born into the IFB. I'm the oldest of four children. Both of my parents attended Hiles Anderson College. That's where they met. After they had been married for a few years, they moved to California. My dad began working at Hopewell Baptist Church, Mike Ray's church, and I remember there was a lot that happened there, but he was the assistant pastor there, and then he moved on and started pastoring his own churches when I was 8 years old.
And I'm always curious, because for everybody it's different, especially people who have been born into it, was there a time where you had a, you know, where you felt an overwhelmingly positive attitude toward the IFB, the churches that you were in, or are your earliest memories, you know, negative? What was that trajectory? Did you have a positive experience with the IFB early on?
So it's a little confusing. Okay. For those that have grown up in it, I was completely sold out to everything that they taught.
Right.
I never even from the time I was very young, I never even considered that there was really any other life out there. I just thought everyone that didn't go to our church or churches like us was just really bad. But I mean, really bad things started happening to me when I was very young. And so I always had this constant sense of fear and feeling of not fitting in from the time I was probably 4 years old.
What was kind of the first thing that happened where you kind of noticed like something's actually not right or something feels really off here?
After my dad started pastoring, I just noticed a lot of how everything was the church. And I noticed that more as I became older, as I became a teenager. I was going to every youth camp with Tim Rule's church, the camp that they put on, every youth conference at North Valley. And I just started seeing, like, I was a really good kid. Like, literally the worst thing that I ever did in high school was watch, like, a Hannah Montana music video. And I thought that I was probably going to go to hell because I did that. I was, like, went to the altar at camp and, like, confessed my sin and thought I was just the worst person ever. But I struggled a lot in high school just with feeling like I wasn't saved. I was going to go to hell, even though I had made the profession of faith at, when I was 5 and then again as a teenager. And so that was just always a constant struggle, even though I wasn't doing anything wrong. I was always striving for that, you know, perfect relationship that they say that you have with God. But I never really started questioning things until probably I had graduated from college and I was married. That was the first time I really started questioning things. There were a lot of things that I saw, but I was really good at giving excuses for why they were happening or for why things were being allowed or not allowed.
And when you say you saw a lot of things, what does that mean as far as the context of what you experienced?
Well, the first thing that I remember, I was sexually abused when I was 4 by a man in the church at Hopewell. Okay. And a few weeks later, he actually committed suicide. And it was this big ordeal. Supposedly, he was this great man in the church. And actually, it just made me sick because the big conference that they had at North Valley, Mike Gray preached and he brought that up. How he was this great man and then he lost him to suicide. And like he had just like literally had just done that to me. And when I had told my parents, it was just like later on, I was scared at first. It was years later before I said anything because the rule was like if you got in trouble, then you would get in trouble again at home. So I thought I was just in trouble from what happened. When that was swept under the rug, saying that it would hurt the church if anything was done. And then I had friends like that had things happen to them and it was swept under the rug saying it would hurt the church if anything was done or if it was turned over to the police, then it would look bad on God and bad on the church and then people would stop coming. I can't even tell you how many times I saw that happen. So many times that happened. Probably went the hardest time I was in college and one of my good friends that was there with me, we had both been struggling with cutting and both of us had gone through similar things with children with a sexual abuse. We were cutting and she got kicked out and I didn't. And it was just like, why would she get kicked out and not me, you know? And that was just kind of like, this is so two-faced and just seeing things like that. Over and over and over again, just showed me that they didn't really care about the people. It was all about the appearances and what people thought about them. That was actually not what was actually happening.
And I'm assuming college experience was Golden State. Was that where you ended up attending, or was it? I'm guessing Southern California. It was either West Coast or Golden State.
Okay. Yes, it was Golden State.
And what was that experience like transitioning to Golden State from your background? Obviously, you were already kind of involved in that world through youth conferences, through being affiliated with all the conferences and things. What was the transition to the college? And do you feel like the college situation felt like it was getting weirder or, you know, more strict? Or did you feel like it was a pretty natural transition?
Honestly, I felt like I had freedom when I went to college, which if anyone knows anything about Golden State, you would think that was crazy. But Yeah, my home was very strict growing up. I wasn't allowed to like go out with friends and stuff like that. It was very strict. Like there was obviously like the no pants, but my parents went further with like the skirts. Like there were no slits in the skirts at all. No sleeveless, no swimsuits, two fingers on your shirt couldn't be lower than two fingers. So when I went to college, I felt like I was living the dream. I mean, I remember buying a skirt that had a slit in it for the first time, and I thought like I was bad, So I just adjusted. I thought it was great. I thought it was really nice, like being able to hang out with friends. There were like a lot of inconsistencies I saw, like I said, with my friend. I had friends like they would do stuff, but it wasn't even bad things. Like I know people would go to movies and get kicked out for a thing, just stuff like that. Like it's nothing bad.
We're not about liquor, drinking liquor, and smoking and dope and going to the movie house and going places you should not go. We're for young people to come here and say, my heart is open to God and I have a tender spirit and I want to grow to seek God's will for my life. So we'll work with you. You'll have to get some demerits for not making your bed. Well, those are childish things properly, or forgetting to sign in or sign out or doing something, those things. But we're talking about rebellious sins. We're not interested in it. I'm interested in dedicating my life these days that God gives me to young people that say, here am I, Lord, send me. I want to be trained for God.
Right. It's just, and I saw like girls, yeah, I saw girls that they were really, really good girls, and they would get demerits for their shirt being too tight when it was definitely not a tight shirt. Just stuff like that. I got demerits. Right. I got 50 demerits one time for sitting closer than 6 inches to my boyfriend at the time. Like, and I almost got kicked out because of it.
And what did you go to college for? And did you end up graduating? Did you end up leaving early? How did that look for you?
Yeah, so I went for elementary education, which is basically a joke.
And basically one of two options if you're a girl. You do elementary education, secondary education, or I forget what they call it. But basically, yeah, secretarial classes.
Yeah.
So
it was a joke. I literally remember being in college classes where one of them we had to plan a wedding, like that was what we were doing,
right?
And like another one on our test we had to like draw the place where we got saved. I was like, is this like for real right now? Like, this is what we're doing in a college class? This is college level, come on. But yeah, I went all 4 years. This is actually almost embarrassing, but like when I graduated, I received the Chancellor's Award. Like, I was like the girl,
So you were really good at drawing. Basically.
Yeah. Well, I was really good at acting and following all the rules and doing whatever they said. I was a great puppet for them. Right. They thought I was great. And I was following all the rules. That was the crazy thing. Like, I didn't question it. I did literally everything I was supposed to there. And I was still struggling all the time, emotionally and mentally.
Yeah. Post college, did you go work at a ministry? Did you, did you do what was probably expected? Did you get married to someone in ministry and head out that way? Or what was kind of the path out of that?
I actually began dating who later became my husband my freshman year. And we dated the entire 3.5 years of school.
Okay.
And we got married a week after we both graduated from college. And we had, oh gosh, I forgot the terminology right now, but where you go to different churches and you like candidate,
deputation?
Basically.
Oh,
you like candidate, basically.
Right. Okay.
For positions. Yeah. So we went all over. We went to like 5 different churches across the country. We considered ourselves more, this is so embarrassing now, but we considered ourselves like more extreme, like we had more rules. Like we got one offer at a church and we turned it down because the pastor was okay with using screens in the church and we didn't feel like we could do that. We could settle into that. So we actually ended up moving down to San Diego. So this is like the weird thing, and this has happened all the time in IFB churches. So the church couldn't afford to actually hire us, So they had us move down there, and we could live in one of their parsonages on the church property. Then we could work like secular jobs and then work at the church. So basically what ended up happening, I worked the secular job so that my husband could work full-time at the church because he did not want to work a secular job.
I'm racking my brain trying to think what San Diego church, because I live in I live near Palm Springs, so so I'm right near there.
The pastor that was at the church, he when we went there, he actually went to Hiles. But before that, it was a different pastor. And that pastor, or the former pastor, actually works at North Valley at their college now. But so it was like completely like Kyle's mindset, you know what I mean?
Which is pretty much what you guys were looking for, was a step stricter than Golden State.
Right, right. Well, stricter than Golden State, or like Golden State, you know. So it was just, it's craziness. But that's what we thought, we were doing the right thing. We were completely like sold out on everything. We wanted to serve the Lord with our lives. We started there, and that was the fall of 2008 when we moved there. We started working there. Our pastor actually slowly started changing on some things. So, like, he let his wife wear pants, but my husband wouldn't let me wear pants yet. Right. Like, it wasn't okay for me. And just things like that, like going to the movies was okay. And then, like, slowly other things started changing. Like, I remember the first time I had a drink, it was a couple of years later, but like, it was like a big deal.
Wait, were you on staff still at that point or no?
Yes.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So
and that was
okay there or no?
Well, yes. So the thing that happened there, the pastor started going like crazy. Like we didn't realize everything at the time, but he was getting addicted to drugs.
Okay.
So he was getting on like all kinds of stuff and making decisions, and a whole lot of things happened. So from the time of 2008 until I think it was 2012 when we actually left, I had been sexually assaulted by a man in the church.
Mm.
And then I was forced to stay quiet about it. And when that happened and I came forward with it, they actually brought the man in. He admitted to everything, and then they called CLA to see what they should do, you know, damage control. Yeah. And they said that they should fire me for it because it would look bad on the church. So the best thing to do would be to fire us so that we weren't part of it anymore.
Wow.
So thankfully it probably would have been better if he didn't. But at the time I thought like, oh, he's so nice. Like, he's not firing me. But then he like in front of people, like in front of my husband, because only a couple people knew that it actually happened. He told me to go press charges against the man, like legally. So I literally went to the police station, filed a report. I get back from the police station, and then the pastor pulls me in his office, and he tells me that if I actually follow through with everything, then he's going to say that I lied and that I actually wanted it and like this whole thing. And then we would be fired. So he said, I drop it. And just tell people that I wasn't comfortable with going through with all of it.
Right.
So that's what I did.
Wow.
So, like, that happened. And then there were, at the same time this was all happening, there were lawsuits on the church to the pastor and my husband saying that they stole money from the church. It was a huge mess. And then it came out, like, he was on drugs. It was crazy. Like, I can't tell you how crazy it was. Like, we would sleep with like bats by our door because there was like a huge church split. Like, people were really mad. Like, cops showed up at the church one day. People found out that I was assaulted, and they all showed up one day at the church, and there was like yelling matches. And then he was allowed to come back, and I was made to stand up on the platform and just like stay there while he was sitting down there. It was awful.
Right.
It was really awful. So finally, I told my husband, like, I can't do this anymore. Like, we have to leave. Like, I will not. Like, I can't. I was falling apart. Emotionally, I was a wreck just from everything going on and all the secrets and just dealing with everything. So we ended up moving to Las Vegas at that point. The church kind of, like, dissolved. I don't even know for sure if it's still in existence now or not. Like, the name was changed and they got a different pastor. Like, obviously they fired that pastor. I don't even know. Yeah. I don't know if that church is still in existence or not. I feel like I'm going super fast. Am I going really fast?
There's a couple things I want to hit on, but you know what? Let's just keep going through and then let's circle back and hit a couple things. I definitely don't want to lose the end of your story, or at least the end of your IFB story. And then I can circle back with a couple follow-up questions, because I think you're doing a great job communicating your story right now. Like, I'm not missing a ton of information. I'll probably just go back and ask for some context here in a little bit.
Okay. Sounds good. So that we moved to Las Vegas in the summer of 2012. Yeah, I believe it was the summer of 2012. My husband and I had talked and we had agreed, you know, let's just like not be in ministry, you know, like it's just not working out. We had seen so many things during our ministry, like that pastor was beyond controlling. Like, we found out he would like listen in and stuff and go into our house when we weren't there and look around and just do all kinds of things. He did a lot of things that were not okay. So when we moved to Vegas, we were like, you know, let's just take a step back. Let's find a church that's not IFB that we can just, you know, grow or just be, you know, we just needed like some healing time. So he agreed we weren't going to work at a church anymore. We found, it was a Baptist church, but it was like Southern Baptist kind of, but between like Southern Baptist and like non-denominational, but it definitely had like, it was like a very large church. It ran like 3,000 people, but they had like the praise and worship band, but they had like all the standards and like the beliefs and like the doctrine and theology that a Southern Baptist would have, if that makes sense.
Right.
We started attending there and I started working at a large Christian school in the area. And my husband was just doing like odd jobs because, you know, our degree, you know, is not worth shit. So it's hard to get like a regular job.
Right.
So especially like his degree was pastoral theology.
Right.
So that doesn't transfer well to the real world. So we were just kind of going to church, like doing our thing. And then we had been there probably 6 months and my husband came to me and said that he wanted to be in ministry again. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to work at that church that we were going to. So he started getting close to some of the pastors that were on staff there. I didn't think he would actually do it just because I don't know. In my head, I thought, you know, he's not really going to. He wants to. He thinks he wants to, but he's not going to. He actually ended up starting an internship at the church. He did that for a little over a year, and then they ended up hiring him at the church. And that's kind of where everything kind of really went downhill for me. I don't know if it was the fact that we were back in ministry again and everything was coming back or what, but I was struggling a lot emotionally. 2017 was when it was really bad and I ended up attempting suicide. Wow. And he didn't want to tell anyone. He told one of the pastors, but then we like kind of covered it up. We didn't tell like any of our family. I guess we didn't want him to know how bad I was struggling. I'm not really sure why. After that, it was just a complete downhill for me. Because I kept struggling after that the next few months. And I'm not faulting my husband for this at the time, but he was trying to find answers and we were both super still like into the church. And, you know, that was our world. We like lived, breathed everything church. And so he started trying to look for reasons why I was struggling so bad. He ended up finding some book online. And he thought that I was actually possessed with demons. It got to the point where he took me to Seattle to have this pastor like pray demons out of me. After that, I remember coming home and I've never ever felt so alone in my entire life. I was so scared of the whole process. Like, I didn't believe in it. I didn't believe anything that was being done, but I was so scared to go against it and to try and like fight it, that I just did whatever they said. And when we got back from that trip, I started going online to like chat rooms to try and find people because nobody from the church talked to me. Like, it got out what I had done, and I literally had no one, literally no one. Everyone from the IFB movement didn't talk to me anymore because, you know, I had changed. I was wearing pants now. They could see, like, I was doing things that they didn't agree with. So I wasn't accepted there. And now I wasn't accepted at this church because, you know, I wasn't trusting God enough or whatever. I started talking to people online, and that's when, like, my eyes just started to become open, and I met people that were like my friend for the first time ever. Mm. And during that time, like, our marriage, like, struggled really badly, and that's when everything just fell apart. Every day was a struggle for us. We tried to fix it. We tried going to counseling, and he was still really in the church. I wasn't wanting to go to church anymore. It got found out that he had actually been stealing money from the church that he was working at. With everything in our marriage, like, a lot of things came out. Like, I was put on medication, and it changed me a lot. And I ended up cheating on him. And so it was just a big mess between everything with the church. And we weren't allowed to go to that church anymore. When they found out, they fired my husband instantly. And I was just through with it. He was still wanting to do ministry. And I was like, I am literally not doing this anymore. I refuse to live my life like this. And so I told him I wanted a divorce. And he tried so hard for that not to happen, but there was no way. We ended up moving to Ohio, and we got divorced, and he's married again. Hmm. And now I don't go to church anymore. I haven't been. I went one time before Thanksgiving, and the last time I went before that was last Easter. But I literally can't bring myself to a church. Every time I try to go, it's like convulsions, like crying, and it's awful, everything that it brings back. From the churches that I've been in. So I guess that's kind of like the end of coming out of it. So I don't think that I completely came out until I actually moved to Ohio, because that's when I actually, like, came on my own and started really thinking for myself. It was a process, like, that last year in Vegas, for sure. But I didn't fully come to myself, I don't think, until I was here in Ohio.
What you're saying makes complete sense of, like, it would be difficult. And I mean, your story, you know, kind of circling back, like, your story kind of begins, you know, one of your formative memories in church is one of sexual abuse. And so that's something where, whether you maybe notice the impact of that or not at the time, you know, it's definitely something that is going to, it's going to create a complicated relationship with the church, with that environment. And even if it's something where, you know, something that wasn't necessarily foreseen by anybody or something that, you know, was expected, it's going to have effects on you mentally. And I'm curious, and again, I know we don't have to dwell on this for too long, but I'm curious, at the church in San Diego, when you had sort of a repeat situation happen, did you remember that childhood trauma and think, like, how does this happen in two different churches? Like, how can I not get away from this? Or was it something where, you know, did you draw a connection between those two things at all? Or did you just, you know, deal with it situation by situation? Because I hear that, and I'm just thinking, like, if it was me, I'd be thinking, like, man, what are the odds? Like, I'm in Northern California, this happens. I go to Southern California as an adult, and this happens. It's like the pattern, even of two, would really shake somebody. And so did you have a feeling at that time of, like, man, why is this happening again? Why at a church? Or was it something where, you know, you didn't really connect those two things?
Yeah, for sure it did. And I didn't even mention, I had also been sexually abused as a teenager as well. So it was like, it was all like increments of like 10 years basically. And went through my head so many times, like, what am I doing every 10 years that's causing, like, am I sinning? Am I doing something? Cause you know how they teach, like, you're wearing something, or you must have done something. And so, like, what am I doing every 10 years to make this happen?
Right.
You know?
And as a teenager, was it at the same church as when you were a child, or was it a different church?
No, it was, that was actually not in a church.
Oh, okay. Okay. So it wasn't connected to that movement then?
No, but it was covered up in the same way.
Were you ever told a reason why they were covered up? That, or was it just always, you know, this is going to reflect negatively on the church, it's going to reflect negatively on that person? Were you not given a reason until that last time? How was that kind of explained to you as a survivor of abuse? How did they justify that action of covering it up?
It was pretty much the same every time, of not wanting to hurt the name of Christ and not wanting to hurt the church. You know, they would say, you know, if people find out about this, they're going to think this is what church is about. Well, you know what? That is what those churches are about, because they let it happen and they cover it up and they let those people stay there, or they just move them to another church.
That's the thing, is like, it's one of those things where it's going to keep happening until it's called out. I mean, I appreciate you being willing to share, because I know that's not something easy to discuss, but it is something where, you know, when it happens once, it's an anomaly. When it happens 2-3 times and is covered up the same way, you have to start asking questions about kind of the belief systems of these organizations. And, you know, and when you prioritize, you know, the ministry above all else, then you're going to see that kind of stuff happen, because you can't let anything damage that. You can't let, it's basically just maintaining reputation above anything else.
And you know, Eric, one of the crazy things about all of that is, during all of that time, I never questioned the church or the leadership. I always questioned myself.
Right.
You know, I don't have enough faith, or it's my fault that this is happening. So, you know, I need to change myself, to the point where when I was 14, I made another profession of faith after that happened, thinking that I must not be saved, because if I was, this would not be happening to me. Right. And then after we moved to Vegas and that had all happened, I thought, I must not be saved. I must, like, not really get it. And I have to do it again. I did it again. I made a profession and got baptized again, because I didn't think that I had this spirit inside me to protect me and to guide me. Like, I literally took it all on myself, and it was destroying me from the inside out.
Do you feel like the theology taught in college helped fuel that kind of mental insecurity, to where you did question yourself more? Or do you feel like, I mean, obviously I know your church background contributed to that, but I am always curious about the college background and how that informs your thought processes.
Oh, for sure. I remember in chapel services where they would preach on different things, and then they would, I always thought it was really weird why they would do this, but it happened several times where a pastor would come in and preach, and then, you know, how they have the invitation at the end, everyone bow your heads. If anyone, talking about like letting go of things and people that have hurt you, and then if any one of you has ever been sexually abused in your life, would you put your hand up and just let that go to God? And I remember thinking, why do they want to know who? And like, I've thought about this over and over, and I really truly believe that when they do things like that, they're like preying on the weakness of those people. They know that they can go to those people and use them for different things, or they have an avenue into that person, because they've already been hurt in that way before, and they can trick them again. You know, they know how to groom them. They literally preach fear into those people.
Well, there's a lot of layers to that. I mean, knowing that information about somebody, and it's one of the scariest things I think that I see in youth groups at youth conferences, where you're filling out a ton of personal information, is you give leverage to manipulators. You give an open door to abusers to know that you have some, I'm not saying weakness in the sense of they have a mental or emotional situation that can be exploited to abuse further. Places like Golden State, and with, you know, the history, I mean, it's not exactly a bright and sunny history of Treber turning over abusers. You know, with guys like that, it also gives them an idea of like what potential troublemakers to watch that could damage, you know, quote unquote, damage the ministry by coming forward. So, you know, that kind of stuff's really concerning. And again, it's something where someone could look at that and say, well, you're reading into it. But again, you have to look at patterns and you have to look at the way this stuff goes down. There is these consistent patterns of how this abuse happens. And even you mentioned, like, there's patterns of who comes in to help facilitate this stuff, and mentioning David Gibbs Jr. with the Christian Law Association. Like, all of that stuff is happening all over the country with the same players involved, the same methodology involved. And you, at a certain point, you have to start just saying, like, oh, there is patterns and there are systems here. And, you know, not all IFB churches are A, B, or C, but there are definitely systems perpetuated in that movement that facilitate this kind of abuse.
I know I've heard a lot of people say, well, like, Jack Traber isn't like these people, and he always, like, he has these systems set in place where he teaches them at the college to the men, like, if these things happen, this is what you do, you report. But let me tell you, I was close to Jack Traber. Throughout my high school years, we wrote letters, like, literally nonstop. I probably had 50 letters from him back and forth. And I was close. We were close. And through college, I would meet with him all the time. We were close. We were friends. And I'm telling you, when that assault happened at the church in San Diego, I didn't know what to do because I had no one. And I called him to get help. And do you know what he told me? It was inappropriate for me to ask him for help, and that I should just do whatever my pastor said to do.
Wow.
So he's not a good person.
I see a guy like Treber, and you always want to believe, like, okay, they're strict on movie theaters and music, but they're not, you know, light on abuse and things like this, or they're not someone who's doing something actually wrong. They just might be really quirky, you know? But I just see it, like, I just see these stories, like, you know, with Mike Zachary and the weirdness of that whole situation of passing staff members along. I see, you know, this Cameron Giovanelli case that just recently came out. Like, there's just things where I see these guys who know everything and who are so in the weeds of their own ministries where there is no feasible way that they don't know the information that's coming out. And, you know, it's the same thing. I see this with Paul Chappell at West Coast is he's not ignorant to the things going around him. And I have a hard time when I see these guys get up and say, I had no idea this was happening, because they are so alpha owning their ministries. Like, they have to, they know too many people. Like, if you're Paul Chappell and friends with David Gibbs, or if you're Jack Treber and friends with all the people that Jack Treber's friends with, you're hearing the behind the scenes conversations constantly. And, you know, it's just, it's disingenuous to say that that's not happening.
Yeah. And I know, like, multiple victims of people at North Valley, at Hopewell, at, Tim Rolls Church. I can't, Pleasant Valley.
Oh yeah. Like, Pleasant Valley Baptist Church.
Yeah. And I know the victims personally. They're too scared to come forward and to say who did things, and that those pastors covered things up, but they are there. They are there. Multiple victims.
Well, let me ask you this, because, you know, there's a lot of layers to this, and you've hit on some of this already, but I mean, the reality is, yeah, there's definitely more victims. You know this because you see every 10 years, there's someone who comes out and says, 10 years ago, this happened. I finally feel ready to come forward. Not just in churches. That's just the nature of, especially sexual abuse cases. It takes a lot of time to be able to accept what happened, process it, and then be able to talk about it. It's just mental. The idea of someone coming forward, you know, publicly 24 to 48 hours later is just not realistic. It breaks my heart knowing that there's people who are even still attending these churches who have had something happen that's been covered up. What is it that's keeping them from coming forward? Is it an obligation to the church and feeling a spiritual, like, I'd be sinning to speak out against the church? Or is it just pure, like, all they know is that world, and it's the fear of if they shun me and kick me out for this, I have nowhere to turn to. Like, do you feel like there's a common denominator with all of these stories?
I feel like it's kind of a combination of things. Definitely how you mentioned the fear of coming out and saying something. Right. Honestly, these pastors, they are able to victimize the victim over again and make them feel like they're the one at fault and it's their fault. And if anybody finds out about it, you know, it's going to look bad on them. It's not going to look bad on the other person. And they're able to just put them down and push them down so much. I've talked to these people and like, this is how the pastors treated them. It wasn't like, let's get you help and like, let's do this. No, they're the bad person.
Right.
Even though they were underage, they were kids, they were teenagers. They were taken advantage of by spiritual leaders in the church that they trusted. And it's just awful. Like it, I think it's fear. And then fear of just coming out and fearing that nobody's going to believe them. And then, I mean, look at Sarah Jackson. She was so strong and she came out and she said the truth, but so many people attacked her and so many people said mean and hurtful and awful things against her.
And like, pastors,
they're scared of that. Right.
Right.
So when that's all their world, what are they supposed to do? If they don't think they can survive on their own outside of that, like a lot of them, their whole family's in there. So they're probably going to get shunned by their family if they do that. What are they supposed to do?
So what do you think? So obviously, like, this podcast is something where I think just by people hearing that there's similar stories is so vital to taking those steps to, you know, make an exit or to, you know, step away from these kind of abusive ministries or situations. But obviously, that's not always going to get people there. So what can people who are advocating for abusers and want to, or advocating for those who've been abused, what is something they can do to create opportunities for victims to come forward in a safe and, you know, secure way?
Honestly, it's tough because when you are still in that whole world, it's hard to know that there is a safe place out of it. So unless those victims are actually willing to look outside of that a little bit, it's going to be really hard for them. You know, I mean, I remember being in it and thinking that there was literally nothing else, that there are no options. There's literally nothing I can do but do what my pastor says, do what my husband says. Like, honestly, even then, that sounds ridiculous as an adult, but I thought there was nothing else. I thought I had to obey them. I had to do what they said. I did not realize that I could think on my own. I could think for myself and that there is actually help outside of that. So just, I think putting people that have come out of it, putting encouraging things on Facebook when you're still friends with those people that are in it, you know, not bashing Thyafi, but like, just encouraging things about being able to be set free and how that you are not going to be miserable and a horrible person if you step out of that, because that's not true.
No, I think that's really helpful information. And it's something I think that people need to hear is, like, you know, one, the show is helpful for victims, but I think there's also people listening who are trying to make sure that this stuff doesn't happen. And if it does, because it is, no matter what, it is going to happen at some point. It's the nature of, you know, just the pure numbers of people. If you have enough people, something bad's going to happen. It's not necessarily always going to be sexual abuse. It could be physical abuse or mental abuse, but that thing does happen. So when a victim doesn't feel comfortable coming forward, I want people to know how to create an environment where it's safe for someone to do so, and what steps they can take when someone does to help them feel comfortable and encouraged. So I am curious for you, because it seems now that you're maybe doing a lot better and you seem like you're, you know, in a much better place than, you know, the times that you're describing in these churches. Can you talk a little bit about your kind of personal healing journey and how you've been able to grow and develop and feel encouragement, you know, stepping outside of this movement?
So there's several different factors that go into that. One was when I was still in Vegas, the last few months there, I ended up getting a therapist because I was suicidal all the time. I was on medication. It was a wreck. It was a complete wreck. I was so self-destructive. It's not even funny. And I didn't even care. I didn't care if I died one hour or the next. It didn't matter to me, which is sad because I had two children and I saw zero hope. But I started seeing a therapist, and she was actually not a Christian. And she's the first one. It was her and a friend that I met online that just was there for me, a constant every single day, telling me, you know, there's life. Like, you can be happy. You're allowed to be happy. You your own choices. You don't have to obey and do everything that any man ever tells you to do, whether it's a man in the church, a spiritual leader, anyone. You are your own person. Nobody can tell you what to do all the time. You are able to make your own choices. So once I finally realized that, and then I was able to just get out and be on my own, it was having a couple close connections with people that I had met that just showed me what normal is. I got an apartment on my own. I bought a car on my own. Just steps like that that seem, for women that grew up in that and that were married, I was married for 11 years in that.
Right.
And I never thought for myself. I never did things on my own. My husband took care of everything. He took care of all the finances. He made all the decisions for our family, and I just submitted and followed. Just being able to come out of that and make slow steps with that, make a decision. Oh, I'm going to decide where I'm going to eat. I'm going to decide what I like to wear now. What do I like to wear?
Right.
You know, just stuff like that.
Right. It's that semblance of independence that can go a long way. Because you couldn't be further from independence in your background. Because you essentially went from, you know, being under the rule of parents to being under the rule of a college to being under the rule of a husband. And, you know, so I think just having that sense of independence sounds like that's been key, you know, to find out who you are and work through your own emotions and not have somebody dictate your emotions and what you should believe for you. You know? And so, yeah, I think that's super, super helpful. So look, there's a million things that you talked about that I think are really important. Like, I mean, we could have a whole nother hour conversation about mental health and the way that mental health is viewed in the church. But I really feel like we kind of found something that's really important. And I think you sharing your story, how you've been able to move past this stuff, how you feel churches should respond, and really identifying the patterns of why this happens is so crucial. And I think it's going to be pretty invaluable for anybody who's listening. So I really appreciate you. I really appreciate you sharing that.
I hope that my story can give someone out there some hope to know that there is life. Like, you can be happy, and it's not a bad thing to be happy, like so many times we're taught.
Thank you for listening to the Preacher Boys podcast. If you appreciated the content on the show, please leave a review on iTunes, and don't forget to connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter with the handle @PreacherBoysDoc. Additional information can always be found on PreacherBoysDoc.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on your Memorial Day barbecue, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound rolls of juicy 80% lean ground beef for $3.49 a pound with a digital coupon. Then get select varieties of flavorful Powerade, Body Armor Super Drink, or Arizona Tea for 77 cents each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.